When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make smart choices about your money. My guest this week is Salvador Rodriguez. He's the Silicon Valley correspondent for the International Business Times, and I've asked him to come on the show to discuss what may be a rather arcane new set of regulations from the SEC that may quietly mark a sea change in what crowdfunding can actually do. Before the Regulation A-plus rules came out, companies could only raise money from accredited investors who are actually required by law to have considerable investable assets, millions of dollars. But the new rules have set forth guidelines by which companies can solicit investments from non-accredited investors prior to an IPO as well. And that means there's the potential for inexperienced investors or less well-moneyed investors to make or lose, and I want to stress the or lose part, a lot of money. So if you're interested in crowdfunding as an investment strategy, either as an investor or a small business startup, you're going to want to hear this report. And after I talk with Salvador, I'm going to answer a question I received from a woman in Florida. She and her husband bought property there in 2006. Yes, if you're thinking that is just before the disaster of the housing crisis hit down there, you're exactly right. Guess what? The property has since lost two-thirds of its value, and she and her husband and their son are juggling some very, very serious financial problems as a result. Believe it or not, I know we talk a lot on this show about how so many people are experiencing incredible housing appreciation. So many people have seen their stock market holdings triple. The economy is booming. People are getting jobs and all the rest. But there are still a significant number of homeowners across the country, particularly in places like Florida, who are trying hard to cope with the fallout from the housing crisis. And I'm afraid it's not just one or two people. Millions of people are having this problem. So stay tuned for what I tell this woman to do and how I think she and her husband are going to cope. Then we're going to wrap up the show with some advice I have for anyone looking to buy a home. But I'm going to stress this, you need to take this advice before you make a bid. So stay tuned and make sure you don't miss any of my suggestions because I'm hoping they're just going to save you a pile of cash. Okay, that's this week's lineup. There is no Glinkonomics report this week due to the 4th of July, but I want to wish everybody a happy 4th. Let's get started with the rest of today's show. Crowdfunding is all the rage these days, and while many startup CEOs still dream of landing a big investment from an angel investor like Shark Tank, right? The trend of amassing large sums of money from small investors on platforms like Kickstarter and a host of others that have been introduced recently continues to gather steam. But while this type of crowdfunding has helped launch some big new ideas, to date, it hasn't quite worked the same way as traditional investments. So investors in Kickstarter projects usually receive something in return for their money, but it isn't generally equity in a business. Might be a t-shirt, might be something else, but it isn't equity. For that to happen, the SEC needs to revise its regulation regarding private investing. And guess what? That's exactly what they did with the new Regulation A-plus rules, which took effect in June. These new guidelines, which were written as a component of Title IV of the Jumpstart Our Business Startups, or JOBS Act, remember that, will allow businesses to raise up to $50 million from accredited and non-accredited investors alike, both sides, prior to filing for a true IPO. Now, to get a better idea of how this new brand of investment funding is supposed to work, I've asked Salvador Rodriguez to come on the show. He's the Silicon Valley correspondent for the International Business Times, and he's just written an article on the new Regulation A-plus rules. Welcome to Big Money Real Estate, Salvador.
Hi, thank you for having me.
That is a very long introduction, but I wanted to give everybody at home some background, shall we say, on how this is actually working. From your point of view, where are you seeing the changes and what kind of an effect do you think they're going to have?
Well, so I cover technology, so my focus has been on how this will affect tech funding. And already we've seen, like on Friday, I wrote a follow-up to my article where I did a quick roundup of five tech companies that are already starting to look at this and use a feature in these new rules called Test the Waters, which essentially lets them go out, talk to their users, talk to whoever, engage the interest that there would be in investing in their company, which is something that they haven't been able to do with other kinds of rules before. So this is pretty interesting. And the fact that there's already this many companies going out and looking at it is pretty promising for these new set of rules. But the entire investment community has told me that they're not entirely sure how this will play out. Some people don't think that there were enough changes to actually make an impact, but others think that for some companies, especially very consumer-facing companies with very loyal customers, might be able to take advantage of this and use it as a way to make their customers feel even more involved with what they're doing by letting them actually, like you said, take equity in their company. So it's still playing out, but it's off to a very hot start.
So accredited individual investors, who are the ones who are always supposed to be investing in hedge funds and other quote-unquote risky investments, they were supposed to have a net worth greater than $1 million or earn $200,000 a year for an individual or $300,000 as a couple. But the new capital market rules, this A-plus rule, seems to allow more people to weigh in. Is that right?
Yeah. Before, I mean, under the rules that we've been playing prior to Friday, it was basically the top 2% of America were allowed to invest in companies that they had no, you know, ties to before they went public. And that's obviously very restricted. Now it's open to essentially anyone who's got some money to spend. I believe you can spend up to 10% of your yearly income. And so that's opening up the playing fields to many more people. And I know from a couple of angel investors and venture capitalists that they're interested in seeing, you know, what your average Joe, you know, your mom and pop is going to do with this opportunity. You know, maybe they'll take advantage and put a couple thousand dollars into one company. But the thing that they do have to remember if they do this is that, as one of my sources said, this is not a lotto ticket. Most companies don't end up going the way of Facebook and Google. So you should only invest what you can afford to lose.
And I want to just re-emphasize that, you know, investing what you can afford to lose. To me, this whole thing, what I've been able to read about it, it just allows people to opt in, you know, get in on these early stage tech investments in your case, for example. But this is also going on in the real estate world. With a lot less information, it feels to me like people who are doing this investing may think that this is an automatic way to be a tech billionaire or a real estate millionaire, but it's extremely risky, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a good chance that you might lose money. There's a chance you might break even, or it might not be too much. But at least this time, though, the people outside the top 2% of America are getting a shot at, you know, really getting some huge returns, like the people who invested early on Facebook. Because, I mean, if you remember, by the time Facebook went public on the NASDAQ, they already had more than 1 billion users. So if you bought their stock, that's great. They're doing really hot since, you know, since 2012. But you clearly did not get in on the ground floor. And at least under these new rules, there is a risk, but there's also a chance at getting those big returns finally. So that's pretty promising. And you mentioned that in the real estate market, there isn't as much information. Now, like I said, it's all still playing out. But one of the websites that I was looking at was called Start Engine. And that website looks at companies that are beginning to test the waters. And they have a whole page for each of these companies where potential would-be investors can go and read about it and learn before they, you know, decide to commit to investing in the company.
well, learning more is really important. Now, the new A-plus rules that went into effect on June 19th, there's two tiers, I think. So the first tier allows up to $20 million to be raised under NASAA review with no state preemption. So investors will have to file in each state, but it's not subject to formal auditing and annual reporting. The second tier allows up to $50 million to be raised, but this requires the companies to do formal auditing and annual reporting. But there is a preemption for blue sky laws, so it removes the requirement to register the offering in each state. But then there's still financial audits and financial reports that have to be filed annually. How aware do you think are the companies who are raising this money that they have all of these reporting requirements? Do you see them actually doing this? And because it's kind of in reverse where they have to do all this reporting, but do they have to do it before they raise the money or sort of on an annualized basis? So it could be after they raise the money. What is your understanding of how people are supposed to get access to the better information?
Well, let's start with tier two. In tier two, they're going to have that first report, I believe, before they actually go public, just like you would if a company was filing for an actual initial public offering. So the potential investors would have to have access to that information before it actually gets going. And then after that, from my understanding of reading all the laws, is that these companies that do go with the tier two, which again is the $50 million option, they're going to have to be reporting these their finances on a twice a year, essentially, right?
Semi-annual.
So it's kind of like an actual public company, but instead of having four quarters, you're going to have two semesters. With the tier one option, that's more restrictive, where they're going to have to, you know, essentially file in every state where they want to be offered. And so in that scenario, one thing that some of my sources said might play out is we might see companies file more regionally. So in tech, you might get a lot of these mini IPOs, but they might be restricted to California, which of course is an area that is very familiar with tech startups and oftentimes gets access to startups before other parts of the country. The restrictions with tier two, with the reporting, that might actually deter some companies from going that route, simply because often, at least in the world of tech, as you guys have probably heard or read, revenue doesn't come until much later, right?
Right.
So in order to avoid having to report loss after loss after loss, some companies may choose to go with the $20 million option route instead.
I don't know. I still think that for people, just average people, and I know you have to have quite a bit of your income, you're basically already in the top 2% if you're going to be able to qualify for this. It just feels super risky to me. I guess we're going to have to see how it plays out. And the cost, just to be clear, for companies to do all of the filing is estimated to be between $25,000 and $100,000. I'm not sure if this is just tier two or it's both tiers. So the real benefits may elude small startups in terms of raising this money, right?
All right, yeah. So essentially, yes, the new tier one, tier two mini IPO options, although this is going to be more freeing for a lot more companies and it'll let more people get into the game, this is for sure not for companies that are still a bunch of founders sitting around with an idea. This is for companies that are about like a year or two into their operations. They're really already out there. They're doing their thing. They are probably going to be very consumer facing and will have customers that are familiar with them. So you're right, this is not for everyone. And just like it's limiting to the companies on the bottom end, it's also limiting to companies on the top end, like Uber or Pinterest, for example. These are two startups that people are familiar with, but these companies are already raising money at such high levels. I mean, Uber's
high valuations.
Yeah, I mean, they're already worth, Uber itself is already worth $50 billion. So there's no point in it trying to raise $50 million this way. So this is going to be definitely very niche. It's going to be for a very specific kind of company, but there will be some out there that it makes sense for.
I just hope it matters for more than just, you know, sort of the middle upper tier of sort of startup companies, you know, the ones that really don't need it. but we'll have to see. Salvador, thank you so much for being with us. That's a great explanation. A whole lot of people found themselves with unexpected financial problems. And for the person who wrote to me with today's question, the difficulties are still being sorted out, and it's been years. I'm Elise Glink. Here's your daily update. So I got a question from a woman whose husband purchased two Florida properties as an investment in 2006 for a total of $600,000. She writes that today the properties are worth a grand total of $225,000, and that's on a good day. It gets worse. In 2006, the husband co-signed a business loan for a son on which the son later defaulted. Both the son and the husband have since filed for bankruptcy. Here's what the wife wanted to know. She asked, "My husband doesn't want to walk away from the properties because he would still have to pay the total condo fees of $700 a month. We're now in our 70s. We can't retire until we get rid of these mortgages. Since we have this pending bankruptcy case, what's the best option? My husband's attorney has been trying to get a short sale agreement from the mortgage lender. In the meantime, my husband continues to make the monthly mortgage payments, which are twice as high as the rental income." Here's how I answered her question. And to really start it off, let me just say this is a great example of how the recovery has really helped a lot of the country, but there are pockets around the country, particularly in places like Florida and Arizona, New Mexico, Michigan, Illinois, the big foreclosure states, where we still haven't seen full recovery. I wrote to this woman, "You didn't mention when your husband filed for bankruptcy protection. He needs to talk to his bankruptcy attorney to understand what his responsibilities are from and after the date of filing." Now, usually when you file for bankruptcy, all of your assets become part of the bankruptcy. In bankruptcy, the bankruptcy trustee then decides who gets paid, when people get paid, and all the circumstances around the payments. Each payment your husband makes for those expenses reduces the amount that can be paid to the other creditors. That's why the bankruptcy trustee is watching this from the get-go. Now, your husband's bankruptcy attorney may have other ideas and options for him to consider, and if he can sell the properties, that might be great. If they're underwater, not so great. Won't be able to sell. But he should understand that he probably will need the court's approval in any case. Once he filed for bankruptcy, his assets became covered by the bankruptcy court, and any disposition of those assets has to be supervised or approved or both. After your husband discusses the situation with his attorney, he should have a better idea as to what his continuing responsibilities would be with those properties. If the bankruptcy is expected to be discharged soon, he needs to find out if these debts are going to be discharged as well. If they are discharged, he won't have a legal obligation to continue payments on the properties, and that means even the monthly payments to the building itself. If that's the case, the lender can then move to foreclose on the properties or accept a short sale if a short sale is presented to the bank between now and then. If the short sale is accepted, the new buyers would take up those payments. They wouldn't be discharged. The takeaway point here is that you and your husband need really good counsel to walk him through where he is today, what his options are going forward, how his credit will be affected, and how his other parts of his financial life will be affected. So please talk to the bankruptcy attorney and then work carefully with the bankruptcy trustee to make sure it's all processed in the right way. The more information that you can find out about the home you're interested in buying, the better it's going to be for you. You'll want to start by researching the market to find out what you can about the target property. But don't stop there. There are a few other key pieces of information you're going to want to discover as well. I'm Elise Glink. Here's today's Real Estate Minute. It's so important to have a good understanding of the overall home buying process before making an offer on a home. Many home buyers simply look at the situation and never consider the seller's point of view. But a lot of times, it's the seller's circumstances that hold the key to what will help make your offer successful. Savvy home buyers know how to research the market, learn as much as possible about the target property, including what the taxes are, when major mechanical systems and appliances were replaced, and whether there are any upcoming changes to the neighborhood that can materially affect the value of property. These might include a road being widened, that happened to me, by the way, or a school being opened or closed. Next, see if you can find out why the seller is selling the property and try to understand the seller's timing for the sale. Is the seller getting married or divorced? Are they having children? Did the seller get a new job, or did he or she just lose one? Or maybe it's just a transfer. Each sale can and will be different, but knowing as much as possible can help you make a more strategic and ultimately successful offer. Now, I often say that buying or selling a home has quite a bit of psychology built into it. If you understand the seller's circumstances and motivations, it can help a lot when it comes to getting the best deal possible. Now, assumptions can prove to be wrong, but the more you buy and sell property, the better you're going to get at understanding what motivates people's decisions and how that motivation can translate into a winning bid for you. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. I want to shout out thank you to Salvador Rodriguez at the International Business Times for being my guest this week. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can, of course, find the show notes to this episode at thinkglink.com. That's thinkglink.com. Also, if you're new to the show and you haven't done it yet, please subscribe. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, I would love it if you would consider giving the show a ratings and or review in iTunes. Here's how you do it. Just search for the Elise Klink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. And once you give your rating or review, this will help the show get discovered by a whole bunch of new people. You can also forward the link to any friends that you have, if you have friends, I'm sure you do, and then they'll listen to it as well. This brings us to the end of another episode of the Elise Klink Show. I want to wish everybody a happy 4th of July. Take some time, grill some steaks, drink some beer, and celebrate what a great country we live in, despite a few flaws here and there. I'm your host, Elise Klink. I'll be back with another episode of the Elise Klink Show next week. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week.